Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture of the billionaire fugitive drug lord in Mexico, El Chapo Guzman, who broke out of a maximum security prison in Mexico 6 months ago and was captured in a shootout by Mexican Marines who apparently were led to the fugitive by a Mexican soap opera star, Kate del Castillo, and the American movie actor Sean Penn. We'll go to Mexico City and first speak with veteran reporter Dudley Althaus, a Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America. He joins us to discuss the redemption of Mexico's president, who was humiliated by El Chapo's second escape from prison while Peña Nieto was on a lavish state visit to France. Then we'll hear from Mexico City-based Joan Grillo, who covers Latin America for Time magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, and the PBS NewsHour. He is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, and his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. We will look into the celebrity aspects of the capture of the drug lord, who apparently was smitten by the soap opera star and wanted his story on the silver screen. And we'll look into the extent to which the grim nature of the mayhem that the drug lord and the war on drugs in general, which have brought Mexico to the brink of being a failed state, has been overlooked in the celebrations over the capture of the fugitive drug lord. Then finally, following a gathering of all of the Republican presidential candidates, with the exception of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, in South Carolina over the weekend to talk about poverty in America, we will speak with Sue Berkowitz. She is the director of South Carolina's Appleseed Legal Justice Center, and we will discuss the gulf between the proposals made by the candidates to address poverty among the unemployed and working Americans and the reality on the ground that Sue Berkowitz deals with in advocating for low-income South Carolina residents. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althaus. He's the Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America, and he has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althaus.
Hi, Ian.
And Dudley, I guess as a journalist now, you've got some competition from Sean Penn, who has a byline in Rolling Stone. He's pulled off a journalistic coup here. El Chapo speaks, a secret visit with the most wanted man in the world. What are you hearing now in Mexico City about any possible jeopardy that Sean Penn may have along with the soap opera star, Kate del Castillo?
Well, it's a hell of a scoop, but it helps to be a movie star either in Mexico or the United States. The Mexican government has said privately that they are investigating both Kate Castillo and Sean Penn, and how they got out there to see El Chapo and looking into possible violations of law and that sort of thing. That might be not really something they're going to pursue, but they're saying it at the time right now.
But it looks as though they had the soap opera star, Kate Del Castillo, on their radar, and that she was the one that was more in touch with El Chapo and led to bringing Sean Penn into the picture, and therefore gave them the information, which apparently back in October they had a possibility to catch him, but he was accompanied by a woman and two children, and they decided not to attack him then. Is that your understanding, that Kate del Castillo is more likely to be the means by which they were able to track down El Chapo?
Well, that's right. I think Sean Penn was basically along for the ride. I mean, I think that, and he said that in his article, that this was basically, this was about Kate del Castillo and El Chapo's appreciation for Kate del Castillo, and that he just was arranged through her, everything. And definitely, it seems like their visit brought hellfire down on El Chapo in his mountain lair. I mean, the Marines and everybody else started their offensive in October about the same time that they had the meeting with El Chapo. So, I mean, I think that you can put two and two together, and definitely it was a direct cause of the Marine offensive in the mountains that ultimately drove El Chapo out of those mountains and down into the coast where he was more vulnerable and was captured on Friday.
So is this a classic case of celebrity worship along with a lust for a beautiful young actress?
You know, I don't know about the lust part. As far as what Sean Penn writes in his article, I mean, Chapo is very correct with Kate Castillo and everything else. But I think, yeah, definitely starstruck in this, you know, somebody infatuated with a star, like the way she portrayed a female drug lord and that sort of thing. And also, I mean, this is narcissism on all sides. Everybody seems very narcissistic involved in this, and that's what brought him down. Very human traits in a guy who was known for coldly calculating his clawing to the top of the Mexican underworld.
So, obviously, the Mexican president, Peña Nieto, is milking this as much as he can. He appeared in a press conference surrounded by military officials and the attorney general, and he's clearly really quite elated at this turn of events, in contrast to the humiliation that he must have felt with that vast entourage that he took to Paris with him on a state visit to France at the very moment when El Chapo escaped from this maximum security prison for the second time in his career as both a fugitive and a drug lord.
Yeah, this was badly needed for the Mexican administration, but the question is whether this is going to really override the ridicule that he received when Chapo escaped last July. And basically tunneled out of supposedly the most secure prison in Mexico. Obviously, the government needs this. Peña Nieto and his Secretary of Interior both emphasize that this means that the Mexican public can trust in their law enforcement institutions or judicial system, whether the Mexican people or those outside of Mexico are indeed going to do that now. Is an open question, but certainly they're trying to make that point about this recapture.
Well, they've taken him back to the very same prison that he escaped from. That raises questions. And then now there's a lot of talk of extradition to the United States. So presumably that's going to be, a embarrassment in itself, isn't it, that Mexico is more or less admitting that it doesn't have confidence in its own institutions.
Right. Well, the political calculations that are very intricate and involved because, yeah, this was a major point of pride that the recapture and people want to trust in their own judicial system, the political elite, the political class here wants to trust in their own system. So I think Peña Nieto, there's a lot of things involved, but the Mexican government did say on Saturday that they have reinitiated extradition proceedings against Chapo. That could take months. His lawyers have the ability to file injunctions that would delay it for a long, long time. So we'll have to see where that ends up. But, I mean, certainly, you know, he is back in the same prison. We hope this time they put him on the second floor so they can't tunnel into his cell. The latest is that the Mexican government has put out small tanks and all kinds of troops around the prison. Whatever purpose that is or what use that is hard to say. But he's back in the same jail and back maybe in hopefully a different cell.
And again, I'm speaking with Dudley Althaus, who is in Mexico City, where he is the Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America. He's covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. So I guess in a way, though, because of all this celebrity stuff and the fairly surprising twists and turns in this story, there's always been criticism here in the U.S. in terms of journalism moving away from seriousness into celebrity. So I guess this story is a perfect fusion of that. What shouldn't be lost in this is that there was a pretty violent shootout. A Mexican Marine was killed. I think five of El Chapo's people were killed. But more importantly, and you've covered this, Dudley, how much bloodletting has gone on in that country? And this guy, he may have seemed like a mild-mannered fellow in a nice silk shirt with pressed black jeans, but he has, rivers of blood on his hands.
Chapo, arguably, is behind a lot of the violence that's happened here in the past decade. He's the one that started the offensive against rivals on the U.S. border, on the Texas and California borders. That really ignited the ultra violence here that we've suffered since 2004-2005. So he's always presented himself as just a drug trafficker, a good bad guy, if you will. the better bad guy, but he absolutely has a lot of blood on his hands. And, you know, I think that the fact that, you know, he was polite to Sean Penn and Kate del Castillo doesn't take away from that. There's been a lot of people killed here in very vicious ways. The violence is still going on in many parts of Mexico, and his Sinaloa cartel is deeply involved in all of it. So, yeah, I mean, this is the article, Sean Penn's article, makes Chapo very human, and actually it's the first real kind of insight in Chapo in his daily life or in his lair, if you will. You know, you have to balance that. This is not a kinder, gentler kind of gangster. This guy is a guy who does what he has to do. And maybe he doesn't gratuitously massacre people, but he has massacred a number of people.
So what's your understanding of the relationships or the connections here between the DEA and other U.S. agencies and the Mexican Marines? Firstly, my understanding is the Mexican Marines are considered the least corrupted. The Federales weren't involved. The state police have largely been compromised. What is the nature of it? Because this feels like the U.S. National Security Agency may have been involved. Do you have any sense of that?
Everybody assumes that the United States intelligence agencies were involved in this. The U.S. Is denying that. They say they were surprised by El Chapo's capture and did not really have anything to do with this. That said, the Marines, not the entire Mexican Navy's infantry, not all the Marines, during the previous presidency, Mexico set up a very specialized group of Mexican commandos, Marine commandos, that were closely linked to the U.S. Law enforcement agencies, and they were the go-to people, the spear, the point of the lance, if you will. And they were responsible for the takedown, killing or capture of many of the top Mexican drug lords of the day. And it continued being so. The Peña Nieto government has backed away from emphasizing the Marines' role. When Chapo was captured on Friday, they praised all the Mexican security forces together, kind of downplaying the Marines' role. But there's a unit, there's an 1,800 strong brigade of Mexican Marines based in Mexico City, and of those, there's about 400 that are especially elite commandos that are used to go after these kind of operations. I'm not sure they were involved in this one, but it certainly seems they would be.
And the assumption is that they're clean, right? That the problem is, it's what's the old expression, silver or lead, plomo y plato?
In other words,
you take a bullet or a bribe, and that's the choices that law enforcement faces in Mexico. And
clearly, I think the smallness of the unit makes them more controllable, and actually I'm sure they're vetted quite a bit. A lot of these guys were trained U.S. Navy SEALs and other foreign special forces, by the way. And I think they're very dedicated guys, and they're very much involved in this. And I think they're less vulnerable to that. That said, when the Marines killed another drug lord in 2009, Arturo Beltran Leyva, the president of Mexico at the time, Felipe Calderon, praised the one Marine that was killed in that operation, publicly named him, and the gangsters went and killed the Marines' family members. So what they do now is they just de-emphasize there's no personality involved. It's a very obscure unit, but they're very key and important.
So how is this affecting other, for example, the disappearance of the 43 students? It still is a sore spot with Mexican people, and particularly with the families of the disappeared. There's widespread belief that the government explanation for that, it was very much a cover-up, and it was also the assassination of a mayor recently. It sounds like for all of the rejoicing at the press conference and Peña Nieto clearly feeling quite pleased with himself, surrounded by his ministers, it seems to me that there's an alternative universe out there that is not going away.
Well, that's exactly right. As much as they're trying to say that this shows that the law enforcement and judicial system are trustworthy and up to snuff to take on the myriad challenges that Mexico faces, a lot of Mexicans aren't going to believe it. A lot of people aren't going to believe it. And we'll have to see. I mean, there's already stuff in the social media, people saying, yeah, you got Chapo, but what about the 43 students? Yeah, this doesn't signify a new day. This signifies a good operation that is kind of a black swan, if you will. But we'll have to see if they can, if this really means that Mexico is getting its act together as far as rule of law and that sort of thing. We'll have to see.
But in general, though, what did you make of Sean Penn's article? Particularly, I was amused by him saying that he asked over dinner, he asked El Chapo about what he thought of Donald Trump. And, of course, I imagine Mexico City Donald Trump is not real popular, given his opening salvo when he ran for announcing his presidential run. He made these gratuitous insults to Mexicans, calling them rapists, etc. But El Chapo said, referred to Donald Trump as mi amigo. So what do you make of that?
Well, I was saying that sarcastically. Uh-huh. But I think that in general, many of my press colleagues are really critical of Sean Penn's article. Look, it was a good scoop. It was a good scoop because he's a Hollywood star. And he was with Kate del Castillo, who Chapo was a big fan of. So, I mean, that's how he got the scoop. But it's a scoop nonetheless. It's one of the few insights we actually have seen of Chapo in his element, if you will. And so I think for that reason it's valuable. I think, you know, it's written in a very Hunter S. Thompson, very Gonzo journalist style, very, you know, adventurous sort of thing. You know, it's being widely criticized for that reason. Sean Penn writes about him farting while he's talking to Chapo toward the end of their night together. And Chapo very graciously ignores the fart and they kind of just move away. And a colleague of mine tweeted out that this is the epitome of the peak of narcissism in U.S. media, you know, describing your fart. So, I mean, I think, and my colleagues disagree with it, but I think it's a valuable insight into Chapo and his element, which he will not return to, most likely.
Well, it feels like, instead of a movie being made about this guy, which apparently was somewhat his El Chapo's Achilles heel, that he wanted a movie, at least that's the assumption, that all of these negotiations were about doing a movie, and Sean Penn was icing on the cake in that regard, it feels as though now you really have a more interesting movie, right? How this all happened. And I imagine at some point or other there'll be a documentary. And by the way, I don't know whether you've seen the documentary about El Chapo, but there is a scene in it where he murders this guy that's sort of chained to a stake, and it's absolutely gruesome to watch. You know, his as he sort of, you know, cold-bloodedly questions this guy who he knows is about to be murdered, and El Chapo is intent on killing this man.
Again, El Chapo's no choir boy. This article makes him a little bit more human, but he's no choir boy. He's a vicious thug, like many of them. He has presented himself as the good bad guy, but he is absolutely a dangerous criminal and a dangerous guy. But he presents himself as a guy who got into the business because there was no other way to get out of his village. The irony is that he remained back in the mountains that he left. As a rich, much richer guy, but he never really, you know, if he's a billionaire, he never really kind of enjoyed a billionaire's life. So this is a guy who got caught up in his own kind of web in his own life. And so, yeah, I mean, in that sense, it's useful to get an insight, to get a peek into Chapo in his world. But, you know, does this make him a likable guy? Not necessarily. And Sean Penn, to his credit, does not say he's a likable guy. Sean Penn had a lot of doubts and a lot of fear about going in where he went. He writes about it. So, I mean, no, this is, you have to take it for what it's worth. I think it's a very good scoop. It's not really key to understanding the drug war or to understanding El Chapo or to understanding anything, but it's a very good scoop and very much worth the read, I think, personally.
Well, at the end of the day, just in closing, Dudley Althaus, what would be really helpful is for the drug consumers in the United States to find a way to stop subsidizing the El Chapo Guzmans of the world. And do you think that that's ever likely to happen?
you know, I mean, they're now legalizing marijuana, which is still kind of the bread and butter money of groups like the Sinaloa cartel. I mean, it's not their big money earner, but it's still an important component, marijuana smuggled out of Mexico. Look, I try to write every time I write about the drug trade here and the drug violence that these guys are making their money smuggling drugs to U.S. consumers. That's exactly the connection. Sean Penn makes that connection in his article. It's definitely the connection. So, something for everybody to reflect upon. That doesn't diminish the importance or the challenge that these guys, these gangsters, pose to governments in Mexico, in Central America, in Colombia, in South America. They pose serious challenges to rule of law, serious challenges to democracy and everything else. But there is a direct connection from the guy you're smoking a joint with or sniffing some cocaine with at a party right back to these guys. And people need to be aware of that. Now, whether that means legalized drugs or whether that means increased enforcement, well, that's the debate.
Well, Dudley Altas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dudley Altas, who's the Wall Street Journal correspondent in Mexico and Central America, based in Mexico City. He's covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be talking with a Mexico City-based journalist who has witnessed the murder and mayhem caused by El Chapo Guzman in the bloody war on drugs in Mexico. ¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México. Nos manejan mal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Mexico City is Jan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS, NewsHour, and the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador, and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. And his latest book just out is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Good to be here.
And obviously, it's a pretty exciting time in Mexico City in terms of the capture of El Chapo Guzman, who escaped from a maximum security prison and has been on the run. But it's a pretty amazing story that's emerging now of the role of the movie star Sean Penn and a Mexican soap opera actress, Kate del Castillo. And at this point, is this something that's going to lead to any arrests of either of these two, or are they protected, I guess, by the First Amendment? I'm not sure how much the First Amendment extends to Mexico. But what's the latest on whether or not they're going to be swept up in this?
Well, yeah, I mean, after an incredible story, how suddenly we flipped over from the big scenes of Marines, you know, kicking down the door and fighting out with cartel gunmen on Friday morning, suddenly to the scenes of Chapo Guzman drinking tequila with Sean Penn in the jungle. I mean, incredible stuff. They've said that both the Mexican and U.S. authorities were watching these people, and this was significant in leading to tracking down Chapo Guzman. It's particularly the first occasion they tracked down Chapo Guzman and attempted to arrest him on October the 6th, 4 days after he'd met with Sean Penn and Kate de Castillo in the mountains. They didn't get him then, but, you know, then he was, you know, we're following him after that. We said 3 months later, to his arrest on Friday. Also, there were, you know, interchanges via various, you know, long codes through lawyers and so forth that they could have been tracking with Kate Del Castillo leading to Sean Penn. But they haven't talked about direct criminal charges yet. I imagine, speculating a little, they wouldn't arrest or try and raise charges against either Sean Penn or Kate Del Castillo. I think it would... the Mexican government have got a big victory with this. Why mess up a big victory by getting into controversy by arresting actors and actresses on a slightly murky legal area? I mean, as a journalist, I've gone out to interview many criminals and drug traffickers, and this has always been a concern. When you go and talk to these people, are you leading the police to them? Are they going to get arrested and are they going to blame you? Or are you complicit? If somebody describes to you how he's murdered people and some of those murders people have not been arrested for, are you complicit? It's a difficult ethical question. How, as journalists, we should cover this? How we should talk to drug traffickers? And what Sean Penn did, I mean, he got the interview with the biggest drug trafficker of all, which many, many journalists would love to have got. And a fair play to him doing that. I don't think it would be particularly healthy to arrest him for doing that.
Well, it looks as though the Mexican authorities, and probably with help from the U.S., I don't know exactly what the relationship between the National Security Agency is and the Mexican authorities, particularly the Marines, who seem to be the most reliable of the government agencies in terms of not being corrupted by the drug lords. It seems as though that Ms. Del Castillo, the actress, is the key here. According to Sean Penn's interview in Rolling Stone, he thought that El Chapo was really interested in meeting her. Mm. It's like a classic, what they call in the intelligence business, a honey trap, you know.
Well, Kate Del Castillo is an interesting character. She played this role of La Reina del Sur, this fictional female drug boss. From a book written, and they get this weird situation where fiction is copying reality and reality is copying fiction. I mean, there's this original drug book, Reina del Sur, was written by a Spanish journalist turned writer who went to Sinaloa and invented this story. He wrote this book about it. It was turned to a soap opera with Kate Del Castillo. The drug traffickers all loved the soap opera and loved her character, this very beautiful young woman playing this character. And then she got into kind of very strange territory where she wrote this letter, you know, saying, you know, Mexico is so sad, all these bad things happening, but I prefer Chapo Guzman to the Mexican president, and why don't the traffickers do some good and traffic with love? And afterwards, according to Sean Penn's story, Chapo tried to send her flowers and then got, you know, started this relationship there. Interchanging communication. And then when he was first arrested in 2014, then they began plans to make a film, to get, you know, her producing a movie about Chapo. Various Hollywood studios were apparently meant to go and be approaching Chapo about making a movie, and he said, I'd want to give exclusive rights to Kate Del Castillo. So it's a very, very strange relationship there, and then she's connected through Hollywood to these people like Sean Penn and could bring them on board.
Again, I'm speaking with Jan Grillo, who is in Mexico City. He's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. And he has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador, as the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. And his latest book just out is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. So in terms of the politics of Mexico, I was watching the press conference where the president of Mexico announced the arrest, and it's sort of, we know that last time he was deeply embarrassed, Peña Nieto. He was on a state visit to France with a huge entourage when El Chapo escaped from prison, and he was humiliated by that. And in many ways, you know, El Chapo, of course, means shorty. And I think that nickname could apply to the president of Mexico. There he was, surrounded by these tall military officers. But it's pretty personal with him, isn't he? He was really humiliated.
It was an enormous humiliation for him personally, for the whole Mexican government apparatus. He has redeemed something with this arrest. Now, in some ways, this is not the president, personally involved in either the escape or the recapture. These are other parts of the Mexican government apparatus, the prison authorities, the Marines, and so forth. But, with the presidential system, he has to take responsibility for these things. He has to have this on his shoulders. And internationally, in the media, he received an enormous amount of criticism after the escape. And, he was, smiling, a very big smile on his face on Friday. I mean, a real smile from ear to ear. Now, it helps him restore something. I mean, little, but something. I think it's a bit of oxygen. Mexico still has an enormous problem with organized crime, with cartels. Just this month, the story which is now getting lost amidst this, but another story opened the year of a female mayor who just got elected in one state of Morelos, and drug cartel assassins went to her home and beat her and murdered her in front of her family. On quite a serious case about these things on the ground and violence still happening, a very horrific thing still happening. And this, in a way, takes away from that, these kind of big picture capos. But, it is at least a psychological victory. When you have the biggest drug trafficker in the country who cannot be kept behind bars, that really gives the impression that the gangsters can win, that the government cannot control, cannot keep order. And when the government puts all these guys behind bars, at least it makes you think, well, maybe the rule of law can win in these countries.
Yeah, but so far, when they put El Chapo behind bars, he gets out. And that raises a question, again, about the very issue that you're bringing up, which is the insecurity that the public feels about the ability of the government to provide them with basic security. And the fact that there's now talk of El Chapo being extradited to the United States is a de facto admission by the Mexican authorities that they can't trust their own prison system.
Well, you could certainly put it that way, that they say, well, we perhaps don't have the capacity to keep this guy in prison, or that it's a constant threat. But then, if you are thinking of international organized crime, it's definitely a global problem. And the United States does have some very secure prisons and a very powerful state apparatus. I mean, it could potentially put Chapo Guzman in the Supermax in Colorado, where you have some of the most famous or infamous alleged terrorists and mafia leaders of the world, are all there. So that they keep prisoners, in almost complete isolation. They have them in bunkers, almost in underground in the desert. But we'll see. We'll also see if he's extradited to the United States. It could be very interesting. I mean, the United States has a history of making deals with drug kingpins who are extradited. And sometimes saying, well, what can you give us? Can we make some kind of deal with you? Can you inform on other people? Can you inform on politicians? Can you inform on other drug traffickers? And then could we give you a slightly easier ride in a less secure prison? So it'd be very interesting to see the discussions, which will be very secret, but the discussions between Chapo Guzman, his lawyer, and so forth, if he does come to the United States. But that will still take some time. His lawyer's already raising many motions to try and stop that extradition, and we'll see how that plays out.
Well, one of the more extraordinary exchanges in the interview that Sean Penn did with El Chapo and in the article that Sean Penn wrote for Rolling Stone is that one point over dinner, Sean Penn asked the drug lord about Donald Trump, who, of course, as you well know, and in Mexico is quite infamous for Trump's opening remarks in his campaign describing Mexicans as rapists, etc. And the assumption, I guess, asking the question by Sean Penn was that he'd get a similar response of indignation from a Mexican. But instead, the drug lord called Donald Trump mi amigo. So what did you make of that?
perhaps a certain sense of humor, a certain joke in that, mi amigo, I mean, a joke. Maybe he sees him as a fellow billionaire. You know, these, yeah, like, I don't think Chapo Guzman, you know, there were rumors before, oh, Chapo Guzman is sending tweets saying he's going to put a bounty out on Donald Trump for criticizing Mexicans, which was likely completely, somebody had made up a tweet or something, somebody had invented it. It's very easy to imitate a drug lord and create a Twitter account. There's no particular reason why Chapo Guzman should necessarily be like a really politicized figure. He's a businessman who's made enormous amounts of money. He pursues those interests. Does he see Donald Trump as being a particular threat to him? No, maybe not. Does he see him as being somebody else who shares the world of billionaires and high-riding lifestyle? Maybe yes. So you could see that. Be interesting to see what Donald Trump thinks of that. It would probably benefit Donald Trump more to have Chapo Guzman attacking him and say, look, I'm the enemy of drug lords. To have Chapo Guzman saying mi amigo might hurt him a little bit more.
Well, clearly the fact that this time in this interview with Sean Penn, where El Chapo did admit that he's a drug lord and a drug dealer, talked about drugs and his own personal, that he doesn't use them and that he acknowledged the damage that they do, but also said that basically what choice do people have in terms of in the Mexican economy of growing and distributing drugs. That was a definite change from earlier interviews where he refused to acknowledge that he had anything to do with drugs.
This is the first time he's done it like a public interview. The previous before, Chapo Guzman had talked to prosecution interrogators and so forth. So like a legal case. And so he just say, I'm not involved. I'm a farmer. But the argument that Mexicans have no other choice, the illegality creates this market, has kind of often been used by drug traffickers to justify what they do. You know, people regularly say, well, look, there's a lot of poverty here. Drug trafficking is a job, is an industry that is providing something for people here.
Well, what's missing, I think, in this whole story, particularly in the Sean Penn, Kate Del Castillo, Rolling Stone, is the fact that this guy is a ruthless murderer and that there's just so much blood in his hands and in the drug war in general, which you can't blame all of it on him, but he's the number one drug trafficker and has been so for decades. There is a documentary or some documentary footage, it's actually a documentary that has this footage, where El Chapo actually kills somebody on camera. Have you seen that?
Sorry, I had slightly cut out in the line here. But certainly there's a very important point. The massive violence is kind of absent from this story. I've arrived at many murder scenes where there's been piles of bodies and there's been a note by them saying, you know, this is a message from Chapo Guzman. You know, you must respect Chapo Guzman. I mean, the one scene there was in the city of Nuevo Laredo where there was, 18 cut-up bodies hung on meat hooks with a message from Chapo Guzman. Now, Chapo Guzman might not be personally involved in this in any way. These are people killing in his name, on his behalf, the kind of army of assassins he has. But an enormous amount of bloodshed in Mexico, and Chapo Guzman has been a real big part of that. If you look at the wave of violence which went on in recent years, the attack on Ciudad Juarez. Now, Ciudad Juarez was one of the biggest areas of murder in all of Mexico. There was 9,000 people killed there over 4 years. It became the most murderous city on the planet. And this is a battle because the people of Chapo Guzman were trying to take the city from the Juarez cartel so that the Sinaloa cartel could traffic their drugs through there. So certainly Chapo Guzman has his people in his name, many, many people, countless people, have died, and that is rather absent from this story.
Well, Jan Grillo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Jan Grillo, who's in Mexico City, where he's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador, and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. And his latest book just out is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Saturday's Republican presidential candidate forum in South Carolina addressing poverty in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from South Carolina is Sue Berkowitz. She's the director of and attorney for the South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice Center, which advocates for low-income South Carolina residents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sue Berkowitz.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Sue, I know you didn't host, but a group of Republican candidates, presidential candidates, with the exception of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, all descended on South Carolina on Saturday. They were brought there by Senator Scott, and also House Speaker Paul Ryan apparently convened this meeting, and it was addressing poverty in the United States. And you actually work hands-on with the issue of poverty in South Carolina. So how did this gathering strike you in terms of rhetoric versus reality?
Well, I felt it was important, if they were going to have such an important forum going on in our state and actually in my city, that I should attend. And I went, and I tried to go with an open mind, but I really didn't hear them discussing poverty differently than I have heard the candidates, past, present, and probably in the future, discussing poverty in America. It was really a telling from all of the candidates about what their vision was about how they would address poverty, but also it was criticizing all of the efforts, and I mean all of the efforts that have taken place, starting with Lyndon Johnson and his war on poverty, and just declaring it a huge failure without talking about their part in constantly fighting the program that the war on poverty was attempting to support from the beginning, fighting them and continuing to fight them for as long as I have been practicing in this area of policy and law. I have always seen that Republican candidates and those policymakers who call themselves the conservatives address poverty. It was pretty condescending, in fact, in that they were the only ones who really had any solutions, but the solutions that they were proposing were no different than the solutions they had proposed. Get a job, go to work, cut out all programs that help support and make a difference in your income, except for a few, and ironically, one of the ones that they were talking about the most, the Earned Income Tax Credit. While they put it down on a federal level, they kept mentioning fraud when, in fact, you know, I don't think that there's any more fraud in the earned income tax credit, you know, than there is in any middle class or tax program for people with means. But in South Carolina, we don't even have a state earned income tax credit. We've been trying to get one passed for probably a decade now to no success. So when they talked about we should double state earned income tax credits, I thought, well, that leaves people in South Carolina exactly where they are today.
And again, I'm speaking with Sue Berkowitz, who is the director of and the attorney for the South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice Center, which advocates for low-income South Carolina residents. We're talking about the gathering in South Carolina on Saturday of all of the Republican presidential candidates, with the exception of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, to address poverty. And, of course, Jeb Bush has called for the end of food stamps. Chris Christie has vetoed an increase in the minimum wage in New Jersey. And Ben Carson believes that President Obama is purposefully depressing the economy to keep people on welfare. He hasn't explained that the logic of that, but he certainly made that charge. So the one thing that I, in terms of what was said, and of course, there was a little bit of drama apparently when Marco Rubio, when some protesters yelled, "Marco Rubio wants to deport me." So, how much did those incidents sort of deviate from the script of poverty as opposed to dealing with the immigration issue?
Well, no, it didn't deviate from the script at all. They really didn't address immigration reform at all, and in fact. John Kasich actually made the comment that he was pleased because when the first outburst happened, it was very, they very quietly escorted the people out. And he made the comment, I believe in reference to what happened the night before in Rock Hill at a Donald Trump rally, that, he was really pleased that the people in this meeting were not, rude and were not shouting out and not being derogatory towards everyone, who was protesting. But by the third one, people got pretty ugly with protesters. I was actually very proud of many of the young people there because I know how hard that is to get up and know that you are absolutely in the minority. They weren't allowing people in the audience to make comments or ask questions, which I found really the worst thing about what took place. It was people up there telling the audience, this is what we're going to do, including things like either getting rid of the SNAP, formerly food stamp program, and also talking about block granting, which if you look at the history of block granting of the TANF program, which I'm pretty sure some of the candidates did not know that that welfare, is what they were calling welfare or cash assistance program, was block granted 20 years ago under a Democratic president. And in my mind, what an abysmal failure it's been, because when you look at the purpose of block granting to give states creativity, as they were all claiming was needed, that creativity, at least in South Carolina, has resulted in a lot of that money being used to have nothing to do with helping people who are living in poverty achieve any kind of self-sufficiency or livable wage, but in fact has been used to patch part of the state budget for a child welfare program. And we have more people living in poverty in South Carolina now, percentage-wise and numbers-wise, than we did prior to the block granting of that program. But we couldn't ask those questions or engage them in that kind of policy discussion. So while they were saying, what we want to do now is listen, there was no listening going on yesterday. It was complete telling.
And just to do the reality check on the work that you do, Sue Berkowitz, mm-hmm. with the South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice Foundation, where you advocate for low-income South Carolina residents, South Carolina's first of all has the highest number of diabetic-related amputations in the country. Its poverty rate is ninth highest in the nation, with more than 860,000 people living below the poverty line in 2013. The state ranks seventh in the percentage of people living in poverty, and 27% of the state's children live in poverty, and 25% live in a food insecure household, putting South Carolina 45th place in the nation for the well-being of children. They're there because South Carolina, I think, is an important primary state. not right. to be educated about the realities on the ground that you deal with.
Right. I mean, we are probably the poster child of why we really do need to be looking at new and innovative ways to address poverty. But, you know, the thing that they did not address is that the poverty programs are constantly under attack, are constantly, we're spending our time defending them, trying to keep them even minimally adequately funded and minimally adequately protecting people's rights, that you can't have an honest discussion about if there is something that's not going as well as you would like for the program, how can we fix it and make it better? And how do we put together programs for each state or for the nation that we would be able to then, all of them coupled together with leverage resources to allow people to live in dignity? Nobody was willing to talk about a living wage, let alone minimum wage. When they were talking about the banking crisis, they were feeling sorry for small businesses, but nobody talked about, the tens of thousands of people in South Carolina who lost their homes because we let Wall Street and the banking industry have a party with all of their money. So we would love to have those discussions. You know, we recognize that we live in a bipartisan world and it really, if you're in a democracy, you want to have all voices heard, but they weren't listening to anybody else's voice. They already had the solutions. And to say that the SNAP program, which is the number one defense against hunger in our nation, and really does work well. When the economy is doing badly, SNAP benefits go up because more people need them. What we don't look at is, well, maybe what we need to be thinking about is how do we provide more benefits in SNAP for people if they need them, or even more important, why don't we look at why are we letting people live with very, very low wage without health insurance? We don't have Medicaid expansion in South Carolina. We really aren't looking out for the working poor as our state leaders and our governor. Why can't we have the discussions, an honest discussion, and really come down and craft something that makes a difference?
And in terms of the candidates and what they said at this forum that was largely organized by House Speaker Paul Ryan and South Carolina's junior Senator Tim Scott. Paul Ryan said, we are not just an opposition party, we are a proposition party. And in terms of what was proposed, from reading through the reports that I've got here on this meeting of the candidates in South Carolina, they were talking about promoting marriage. And Ben Carson saying the real answer to poverty is not government, but the private sector. Compassion is not measured by how much you spend in Washington. That's what George W. Bush. They talked about drug addiction. The Republicans have been big champions for drug testing people on welfare, even though statistics indicate that there's virtually a non-existent problem in the first place. But it obviously humiliates already poor and humiliated people. And then, of course, Huckabee was on this similar vein of Carson's, that there's an industry of poverty, as though the Democrats and the government actually want poverty and somehow thrive on it, never without explaining exactly what the quid pro quo might be in such a bizarre charge. So the one thing that caught my attention was that Jeb Bush did castigate his fellow Republicans for effectively beating up on the poor and saying, that we've got to engage and win these people over, not punish them.
Well, and they kept talking about we need to go into communities, go places where we're not comfortable. And, I give him credit because I knew the feeling. I was in a place where I felt very uncomfortable yesterday. Not among the people I'm usually going to talk with. I'm usually in the communities talking to the people who are impacted by the bad policies that they're talking about. And so he did discuss that. But, at the same time, he was also advocating that we don't need the SNAP program or we need to be block granting. And, to think that marriage, it's understandable that if you have two incomes in a household, people will do better. But to say that suddenly we just say people have to be married, of course, you know, this is the same group of people who don't want to see those of the same sex married. If it's going, you know, if it's good for heterosexual couples, it should be good for homosexual couples as well. But they're talking about, well, we've got these solutions. We need to be going into the communities and talking to folks. But if you looked at the folks that were sitting in that that room, if you did not know about it because you keep up with things nationally, you would. Most people in Columbia, South Carolina, had no idea this national forum was going on. It purely had to do with the presidential primary and, you know, getting it out to supporters of various candidates to get them there. It had nothing to do with going out into the community. If they really wanted to hear, to truly hear from the community, there were very different neighborhoods in Columbia, South Carolina, where they could have gone, and a very different group of people they could have been talking to.
Well, I suppose to be charitable, though, that it is quite the opposite to the private remarks from Mitt Romney talking about the 47% of freeloaders. I guess the assumption has always been the Republicans are not interested in the poor because they don't vote. And if they do vote, they vote Democrat. So something has changed, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I truly believe that, and you know, the work that I do in a state like South Carolina, I cannot only talk to people who think exactly like me. I have learned to talk to all different people, you know, as far as policymakers across party lines, because that's the only way that you can make a difference. And I would say that for, you know, all of these candidates to assume they can't talk to someone because they're of a certain socioeconomic income level is both closed-minded and cuts off opportunities for them. Just like if I'm not willing to talk to people in both parties and people who might consider themselves conservative on issues, then I would be cutting off opportunities for the communities that I'm advocating for. You know, and I would like to see all of us, meaning myself as an advocate for the low-income community, as well as people who are advocating for business, to be sitting down and talking with each other. I actually saw someone I knew from the State House who runs a very, very, very conservative think tank, who told me when they were talking about the earned income tax credit, he was thinking about me, and we both laughed and said, yeah, but double of nothing is nothing. And I said, well, then I hope I will hear from you next week we can start working on the earned income tax credit.
Well, Sue Berkowitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Sue Berkowitz, who's the director of and the attorney for the South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice System, which advocates for low-income South Carolina residents. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.